Good evening. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Along with Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, we run a thing called the Technical Met. Stand by a minute while I change something here. One of my receivers is not running quite right, so I had to switch over to another one. Okay. K2KUY and K2LIW run the Technical Met. Nowadays, I think we should rename it. This is session number 1221 of what I'm going to call, for the time being, the Digital Television Technical Met. The reason I'm saying that is if you listen to the playback for the last 4 weeks, digital television was the main subject of discussion. As you know, on February 17th, it's going to make one hell of an impact on our television watching capability. And you and your neighbors are going to need a lot of help, it says here, of understanding what equipment is required, how to set it up right, what is the system capable of doing, and so on. So that's one of our main subjects of discussion. It's a very fancy piece of electronics. It's got extremely high technology. You study the manuals that are written by the MSW, I think it is, company. Gary Scrignoli is one of the chief engineers who has literally invented the technique by which digital television is transmitted, and it's not just a simple matter of converting your analog bits into digital bits. Not at all. A lot of fancy things are going on as far as data compression, data overlap, randomization in time, all kinds of things, equalization networks, all to give it greater survivability in the real world of impulse noise and multipath. Okay, a person signs into the Digital Television Technical Net. You sign in by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name. You gotta give me the name because I'm so darn forgetful. And you follow that with the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. While I was getting ready, I heard W2RIA Paul sign in, so he's already on the list. Do we have anyone else that would like to sign in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
WHYY, Joe. Yes.
Joe recognized. Anyone else?
Hey, good evening all. This is K2KEY.
That's some guy named Mel. We've heard of him before. Anyone else?
KC2TND. Finny. No traffic.
Okay, TMV Vinny with none. And Rich N2EO, do we have you on board tonight? And Paul from US2N, do we have you on board? Apparently not yet. Okay, Paul W2RIA. If you're there, I think you had a comment or a question or whatever. Paul, if you're there, go right ahead at this time. Okay, Paul's not there. Gee, we're batting 1,000 here. Joe, you're number one on the runway. You're the only aircraft to take off here. Take your time and give us lots of questions. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. Hi, K2RYY. The only question I have tonight was I sent you a link on a bunch of amplifiers that are made by WineGuard, and I was just looking for some, I guess, some advice or whatever you want to call that's related to it. As far as which would be the best selection, something with high gain or something with lower gain but more susceptibility to overload? Because the thing I'm thinking of is this. When they start putting more of these services up at 700 meg and above, which is what the band is going to be used for, I think above channel 51, which is that 700 meg, and these services start getting scattered all over the place and so forth, will these amplifiers and or decoders be more susceptible to this kind of interference, being that they're basically made to work across the entire UHF TV band, which goes as high as probably 800 meg.
I think the answer you don't want to hear is absolutely yes. Whenever you add a preamplifier in front of a receiver, you pick up some advantages, you pick up some strong disadvantages. And which are you going to tolerate and whatever is what we're going to discuss right now. Let's assume that your particular television set at a 12 decibel noise figure. The word noise figure really tells you something about how weak a signal a television can properly operate with. Noise figure is a fairly complicated thing with reference to receivers, but it is a way of measuring in a universal manner sensitivity. So a 12 decibel noise figure is what will, I'm going to make a rough guess that your television might have, and maybe when Eric comes along you'll correct me on this. Zero dB noise figure is the most desirable thing to have, but it's almost unachievable. 1 dB of noise figure in certain situations, and half dB of noise figure is achievable. And at first you'd also think that a half a dB noise figure is not worth fighting for to get it down to zero. Well, there are certain situations with a cryogenic antenna, an antenna looking at cold sky, when that last half a dB makes a huge improvement. But for an antenna looking at the horizon for terrestrial television reception, that doesn't apply. Now, if the preamplifier had, let me pick a number, 3 decibels of noise figure, and if your television has 12 decibels of noise figure, and if the preamplifier you're adding has 10 decibels of gain, very rough rule of thumb, you would think before plugging in the real equation that 10 dB of gain, 12 dB of noise figure, you subtract an awful lot of the 12 dB because of the 10 dB of gain, you're overriding it with the preamplifier. The preamplifier's 3 dB of noise figure, you'd like to believe that's going to be the result in noise figure. It's going to come out something like 3.5 or 4. But you're going to make a significant number of, if it was 4, that's an 8 decibel improvement, and it's worth fighting for. That's with 10 decibels of gain. And you're absolutely right. Let me drop. A preamplifier for this particular kind of service, if it was the best kind of preamplifier in the world, would have a tracking filter on its front end. In other words, when you tune to channel A on 620 megacycles, you'd have a bandpass filter at 620 megs. And so the zillions of signals that are on the air television-wise, and your local taxi cabs and fire and police and all these transmitters won't overload your system. By that I mean a preamplifier that has no tuning is extremely broadband. A preamplifier may go from channel 7 UHF, 174 megs, all the way up to 500 or 600 and some odd megacycles, maybe even 700. And the preamplifier itself is kind of difficult without putting a lot of fancy filtering inside to even make it cut off at those frequencies. The gain will fall off at higher and lower frequencies, but it's still got gain. So, to a small degree, a preamplifier is going to have some amount of gain DC to light, if I exaggerate a little bit. When you add that preamplifier, the good news that I just told you is you pick up noise figure improvement. The exact calculation of noise figure improvement is a formula you can look up in a whole lot of places. And the total system noise figure equals F1, noise figure of the first stage, plus F2 minus 1 divided by gain 1. And all of these F numbers must be real numbers, not decibels. You've got to anti-log all of this in order to use that formula. But that's the cascaded noise figure formula. And if you've got a third stage that you think is contributing, it is F3 minus 1 divided by gain 1, gain 2. So you add up all these terms, you get the resultant system noise figure, you play with the numbers by adding more and less gain in that preamplifier, the G1, so to speak, or the G2, and you can find out what the overall system noise figure is going to be. That's the first step. And so you can, if you know the noise figure and the gain of your preamplifier, and if you know the noise figure of your television set, mathematically, you can predict exactly ahead of time, to a small fraction of a dB of accuracy, what is the new noise figure going to be. Unfortunately, that's only half the situation. When you study almost every one of the Southeast Asia-made ham radio rigs that we can all buy, you'll discover that almost every one of them is gain-starved. In other words, the front end has extremely high noise figure, and there is, in some cases, no...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In some cases, there is no preamplifier. In other words, the signal comes in, maybe a tiny bit of preamplification gain, but then it goes into the first mixer. And most of the Southeast Asia-made ham radio rigs that we can buy, very good except for sensitivity. They've got 12 and 13 and 15 dB of noise figure. And so the first thing we amateurs do is to add a preamplifier in front of it to bring its sensitivity down to the single sideband mode. That's the good news. But why did Japan manufacture all those rigs without the preamplifier? And it's because of overload. If I add 10 decibels of gain in the preamplifier, the rest of the receiver downrange is usually the first thing that saturates. common sense would lead you to believe you've got an extremely broad preamplifier. You'd think the preamplifier is the first thing that's going to saturate if there's a strong local signal. Occasionally that's true. 90-some-odd percent of the time, it is not true. The first thing that saturates is the second or third receiver stage downrange, because you've accumulated 20, 30, 40 dB of gain when you get there. So that's the first stage that overloads. So adding 10 decibels of gain will, in general, lower your dynamic range of your receiver system by something close to 10 decibels. You pick up a little bit of sensitivity improvement, but you sacrifice some strong signal overload characteristics. And I'm being a little pessimistic when I say 10 dB of gain, you lose 10. You probably lose 8 dB or 7 dB of signal to output system dynamic range. So putting in a preamplifier is a mixed blessing. If this is the best of all worlds, you'd have a bypassing relay around the preamplifier where when the band is quiet, you turn on the preamplifier and you get best sensitivity of your receiver system. When the band is super busy with strong signals, you bypass the preamplifier by flipping the relay switch. As crazy as that sounds, I've done that on my VHF contest that I've operated. There are a number of cases where not only did I bypass the preamplifier, but I put a step attenuator in the front end of 10 or 20 decibels in order to listen to a somewhat weak signal on the 432 band. When the guys up in Connecticut are bombing me with super strong signals right across the pond. The good news is my land in Huntington is 300 feet above sea level. The bad news is from the top of my tower, my antenna has direct line of sight to those big signal operations in New Jersey and Connecticut, and sometimes on Long Island, that bomb the daylight.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So I might have a weak signal I want to listen to alongside of a strong signal. The strong signal is overloading my receiver, something fierce, by bypassing the preamp and plugging in the right amount of step attenuation in front of the receiver. I all of a sudden can listen to that weak signal that's alongside of a strong signal. I'm not getting the best sensitivity, but I'm drastically improving the dynamic range so I can suck him out of the noise. I've operated that way on a number of occasions, and occasionally I've used nothing but the 432 band during a June-September VHF contest and won the New York City Long Island section, took top score, using nothing but 432, not even using 6 meters and 2 meters, because I had a pretty big antenna, and I was using those kind of receiver techniques. So the bottom line of all this, of what you want to know, is you probably think that a 20 dB gain preamplifier is better than a 10. When it comes to sensitivity, yes, but it's the law of diminishing returns. You take that cascaded noise figure formula, plug in 20 dB for G1 instead of 10 dB for G1, you'll see that the noise figure is better, but it's not a whole lot better. But a 20 dB gain preamplifier is, in general, going to lower your strong signal tolerance by 20 decibels. So the best of all worlds would be a way of bypassing the preamp and or a way of putting in attenuation under certain circumstances. I wish the situation was a lot simpler, Joe. I know this is a hell of a lot more complicated answer than you expected, but these are some of the factors involved. I wonder if I'm hearing somebody that wants to make a comment on this. If so, give me a call with us right now before I turn it over to Joe, K2LAW on the TechNet.
K-E-Y.
I heard Mel. Who was the other person?
K-3-3.
Eric, in that order. Okay, Mel first. Go ahead.
You know, it comes down to simply what I do the same thing on HF. I actually ride the RF gain. I find I leave the audio gain set, and I adjust the RF gain just to hear the contact, especially on CW. You'd be amazed how much it improves the capability of copying a signal. Many times when you can just reduce the RF gain just to the point where it's at the threshold of hearing the signal take over.
Fantastic. And what Mel's talking about is in the earlier receivers, particularly things like Drake and Collins, you had a real RF gain control on the front panel. Many of our modern rigs don't have that anymore. So the variable attenuation I was talking about that I was plugging in front of my receiver, on the old receivers you had that by way of turning a knob, but the knob itself was not the attenuator. It was adjusting a voltage on a control grid or a suppressor grid or a screen grid and the first preamplification tube, and you were lowering the gain of that tube proportional to what you needed for that particular service. And as you lowered the gain, you had less overload characteristics of the stages downrange in the receiver. Let's see what Eric's got to say about all this. Wonder what your experience is with using a preamp. My guess is for you to use a preamp in your environment in Plainview is a little bit difficult because the preamp, if it's an extremely broadband one without pre-selecting filters in front of it, alongside of a broadcast station, which is running 50 kilowatts or whatever, my guess is it's very easy for you to overload a preamp. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet, the digital television TechNet. You got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, I have your the preamp up there, and it is somewhat problematic, but I do something smart. I have a single-channel filter, and I notch out my big transmitter so I don't hear it too much. I mean, it makes its way in there. But, you know, preamps have improved over the years, and typically today, you get a preamp which is generally to run from like 10 to 12 dB gain. And the average noise figure of the preamps these days is around 3 dB, which is not bad. They don't really start to overload until you hit about 300,000 microvolts, 350,000 microvolts. And if you're really smart, you'll get, especially for the digital, you'll get a preamp with an FM trap in it, especially if you're going to be doing, looking at the VHF, which around most of the country, it's pretty much there. You know, sucking out the FM is very helpful. There are, with the digital, I found places where the preamp is useful and other places where the preamp is just a big problem, especially when you have multipath happening. So, back to you, Dick. And I see that a friend in Texas is with us also. K2RW, K2J.
WB2CUK with a comment.
Okay, Bill CUK, CUK recognized. 350,000 microvolts turns out to be plus 2.4 dBm going into the preamp. If the preamp had 10 dB of gain, that would be plus 12.4 dBm coming out. And not too many preamps have plus 12 coming out before they overload. That's one factor, but still, that's pretty good. I think many preamp transistors can put out around plus 10 or so. Some of them are going to put out plus 0. But some of the better ones can put out plus 10 or plus 12 before they overload. However, the preamp itself is not usually the first thing that overloads. It's the second or third stage downrange in the receiver with all that gain increase in front of it that experiences the first overload. And you can find this out pretty fast by plugging signal generators into your receiver and doing the right kind of a test with a weak signal and a simultaneous with a strong signal with a certain spacing away. You can fairly rapidly Joe, in particular, where he owns a service monitor and a signal generator, he could do a fairly simple test of summing two signals together, even with a T-connector, it would work, and then finding out what his strong signal overload characteristic of his particular receiver is. And so to measure that on the barefoot receiver before putting in the preamp gives you a predictability as to where the overload characteristic is going to be after you add the preamp. Let's see what Bill's going to say around about all this. WB2CUK, K2LAW, you got it, Bill.
Papa. Hi, Dick. Dick, is this, are you talking about this in reference to digital TV, basically?
There's a yes and no about that, Bill. Primarily what I'm saying about adding a preamp in front of a ham radio receiver or adding it in front of a digital television set pretty much works the same in both cases. The preamplifier, if it has significantly lower noise figure than the rest of the receiver system, whether it be ham or television, the preamp will make a significant improvement in sensitivity. That's the good news. But whenever you add a preamp, with rare exception, you are almost dB for dB by way of the gain of the preamp, cutting down your strong signal tolerance by the same number of dB. In other words, if the strongest signal my receiver could tolerate is 0 dBm, and I plug in 10 decibels of gain as a preamplifier in front of that receiver, now my receiver is going to overload at minus 10 instead of 0 dBm. I think you see what I'm saying here, Bill. 72CUK, K2RIW.
All righty, I understand that. I guess what you might be able to do is, on your AGC line, put some AGC on that preamp, so maybe on real strong signals, reduce the gain. But I got a political comment that I want to make about this digital TV stuff. You know, after listening to a couple of your tech nets and hearing how the things are going to be a little more critical in receiving, it almost sounds to me like a conspiracy of the electronic manufacturers to force this garbage on us. You're not going to be able to sit on your porch and watch TV with an antenna like you used to be able to. At least that's what it sounds like. And a lot of people are going to spend a lot of money, I think unnecessarily, to get the same garbage programming that you see watch TV. They get the same garbage. So I think it's a conspiracy, and I think there should be an organized ham protest for digital television. But I got fired, so it's not going to affect me. But I'm thinking about all the people who like to sit in their porch and watch a baseball game and stuff like that, and it's probably not going to happen now. And it seems like every 10 or 20 years, the electronic industry needs to make a little more money. So this is how they're doing it, Dick. Back to you. Just a little bit of political comment here. Okay, all right, WB2C, you got it.
Okay, you gave us two subjects, and I'm going to approach both of them. Number one, if you added each AGC to the preamp, yes, you can cut down its gain. However, depending on how you do it, most preamplifiers, as you cut down the gain by way of the AGC terminal, also lowers the intercept point of the preamplifier. In other words, the maximum power output it could generate also goes down. And so you may be gaining and losing equally as fast, and you may not come out ahead. If the preamplifier was the overloading device, if the receiver downrange was the overloading device, and as I said earlier, I think 90% of the time that's true, then yes, your AGC voltage comes out ahead. Now, with reference to digital television, yes, there's going to definitely be some grief, Bill. We're going to have to spend some more money for converter boxes and or digital television sets itself. For the people who have seen digital television in its finest form, a high percentage of the population says, yes, that's worth it. I like that. For the guy who sits in his backyard in Brooklyn with rabbit ears, he will get digital television, in my opinion. For a guy who sits in Farmingdale, which is, I think, where you live, which is 30 miles east of New York City, depending on what the terrain is like between you and the Empire State Building, you will, with your rabbit ears, get Connecticut stations, and will you get all of the New York City stations? That remains to be seen. And if you're willing to use the aerial on the roof of the house, which normally has a cable going into your living room, and if you're willing to put an extension on that cable and run it to the backyard, and you sit in the backyard with your television set, you're going to be able to watch digital television in the backyard. Because of where you live, not all of the channels are you going to be able to get with a rabbit ears. So it's not quite as bad as you say. Without a doubt, you're right, Bill. Some of what's going on, and Eric has told us that, the dollars involved is one of the many driving forces. First of all, we're pulling ourselves up, we're bootstrapping ourselves into the 21st century, because when it comes to digital television, a high percentage of the European advanced nations have been doing it for some time. They've got a slightly different system, but they've got digital television. And so, analog television, we're one of the few nations that still has it, and from that point of view, we're in the dark ages. So we haven't come up to the 21st century. So, there's more involved.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Let me turn it back to you, Bill, and see if you understand what I'm saying about the rabbit ears in the backyard versus the aerial on the roof going through an extension cable into the backyard. WB2CUK, K2RIW.
All right, Dick, yes, you explained it pretty clearly, and I might not be here in Farmingdale for too much longer. We may be moving towards the middle of the year to another location. I don't know if it's going to be here on the island or whatever, but when you get older, Dick, when you get to be 60 or older, you get a little cynicism, you know, that tends to creep in, so I just thought I'd mention that. Yes, they've always had a different system in Europe. I remember I was there in 76, what is it called, CCAM? Or whatever it is, I remember watching TV and that the picture was much clearer the way it did. I think they used like 800 lines instead of 625 or something like that. And that was in the 70s. But all right, Dick, I got a cassette recorder in front of me here in a million pieces. I'm trying to put a new belt in. And just one of those ones that you got to be almost like a little ferret to get in there to get this belt changed. So I'm listening to you now and I'm enjoying it. KQRIW, WBTC, you guys.
Very fine, Bill. I can see how you're a little unhappy with all the changes you got to get. I make in order to get television. But I think when the smoke settles, I'm convinced we're going to come out ahead. We're going to pay a little bit. There's going to be some pain up front. But I think we're going to come out ahead. I'm going to turn it over to Eric before I turn it back to Joe and see if Eric wants to amplify any of what I just said. KE2EJ, a broadcast engineer, KQRIW, the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Now, the one thing that you have to realize is that the reason the digital television came about actually has been worked on since 1980, believe it or not. High definition, been around for that long. Actually, in Europe, they're only now starting to get into high definition. It's been there on the satellite for a while, but not over the air. The real driving reason for it was that this last bunch of Republican-driven Congress decided that there is this potential to make several $1 trillion from this space of landscape of spectrum being vacated, which actually didn't quite come to pass the way they expected it to. And that was more of the driving reason. And the reason for it is that digital television allows you to have your channelization with the co-channels. You can have a channel 22 and a channel 23, or a channel 4 and a channel, there's channel 3 and a channel 4 next to each other, or a channel 7 and a channel 8. And you don't have the problem that you have in analog television. The analog television, the adjacent channels, I'm sorry, I said co-channel before, the adjacent channels you must not have an adjacent channel right next to you in the same market. For obvious reasons, the sound carrier banging into picture carrier banging into sound carrier, and various other problems that are there. And that was the original driving force for it. It's a pretty good system. There's still a ways to go in terms of development down the receiver side of things to make it a little better, whereas that the later variety of receivers are more rapid and capable than the previous generation, and the next generation will be even more rapid and capable. So as time goes on, as that technology develops, it will continue to... I see our friend out in Texas said that was Hillary's friend, not the Republicans. Well, I disagree with that. It was the Hillary's friends in terms that made it happen, but that's not where the driving force came from. Now back to you, Dick. K2IW, KE2J.
Tell me about whiskey.
Somebody, whiskey? Yeah, go ahead. What was your call letters again, sir?
W2 Papa Whiskey would like to get in line with a question about preamps.
Okay. And your name is, sir?
W2 Papa Whiskey, name is Press, P-R-E-S.
Very fine, Press. Let me turn it over to Kent, W5BJB, coming from the Dallas area of Texas by way of VOIP or whatever, or maybe it's a Echo Link, but anyhow, by one of the modern digital techniques, he's getting up here, and I hope his signal sounds a little bit better today. I believe Kent is relatively sure that the Clinton administration, we hold them up as a very successful administration because they balance the books as far as the budget is concerned for the nation. However, I believe Kent feels that some of that balancing of the books was done by selling frequency spectrum. Some ridiculous numbers of billions of dollars of frequency spectrum was sold at that time. That created a revenue flow that balanced the books. But when it comes to really controlling spending and taxes coming in, did they really balance the books is an interesting situation. Let's see if Kent's got opinions on that or any of the other things on the table. So the A5BJB, if you're there, K2RIW.
Well, hopefully we're a little stronger than next week. We'll be moved in. There was plans to move us to digital, I agree, but the idea of roping off 28 TV channels to sell the frequency spectrum does go back to Hillary's friend. So forcing the stations to go digital, forcing the stations off the air in order to earn money was the plan. The budgets in the 90s showed a $1 trillion income from selling the spectrum. They showed a $1 trillion income. They just finished the first set of the rounds of auctions. They've made 9,000 TV stations change. They've made 100 million people get a new TV converter or a new TV set each. And all this raised $19.2 billion. All this raised $19.2 billion. So this was our government. This was our government doing this to earn money. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. WA5BJB, and my comments into the tech net. Over.
Very fine, Ken. You sound a hell of a lot better this week than last week. Last week, when you played back the recording, it was extremely noisy. Last week, you had about 70% audio and 30% noise. Today, you're more like 95% audio and 5% noise. A hell of a lot better. So I can tell that Eric is making improvements in the system in the way the interfacing occurs. And I still said that last week, you are the first person that's really called in far out of the area. Okay, let's go back to Joe and then pick up Chris in that order. And in between, we'll probably have some further comments by Eric. Joe, I wonder if you got some of the answers you were looking for so far. W-E-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, in the digital television TechNet.
Answers I'm really looking for, because, you know, I'm asking a question, and everybody else listening could be in the same, in a similar situation. Living 45 to 55 miles away from New York City, and yes, I can get cable, but I'd like to try it outside the antenna and see how I can pick up these shows on, you know, digital television. And the problem is, like I said, as the band opens up 700 meg and above, what's that going to do to not only these TVs, but these converters? I don't even know what the noise figure of these converters are or how much overload they will take the stuff out of band. Because the antenna and the preamp will be supplying signal to a converter, not to the TV directly. So it's the converter that's the problem initially, not the television set. And with the list of preamps I gave you that, in particular, like WineGuard happens to make, some of those preamps had gains as high as 28 dB for UHF and 17 or so for VHF, and had noise figure approximately 3 dB. The higher gain preamps would overload with, say, 29,000 microvolts or higher, and the preamps with the less gain, 10 dB of less gain, had ratings of typically 175,000 microvolts or higher would overload those. So here comes the question, I guess related to this, does anybody on here know if anybody makes a filter that will be able to cut off stuff above channel 51, because we don't have to see stuff or be able to tune stuff above channel 51 in case you get overload with these new services that eventually will go up on that part of the spectrum. Back to you, Dick.
And whether or not that filter is available right now, I'm going to turn it over to Eric for two questions I'm about to ask him. Number one, does he know of a filter that we can buy now? And the answer might be no, he doesn't know of one. However, as those services go into effect and various television watching public starts running into problems, then I'd like to believe that some smart person is going to come along and start telling us the filter that we need. I mean, the system that we put up now, Joe, doesn't have to be perfect at first. You know, everything we amateurs do is that we get it on the air first and then tweak it later on and make these improvements. In the case of Eric, where he's got a 50 kilowatt station or something like that, transmitting right at the location of his television receiving aerial, he had to put in a filter, a notch filter, to notch out that signal, otherwise everything in the world would be overloaded. When you've got that kind of power that close, even a filter and the leakage around the filter is going to give you a little bit of grief. So my first question, though, now, Eric, and it's related to what Joe is asking is, number one, do you know a filter, bandpass filter? Number two, when it comes to overload characteristics of the currently available digital television converter boxes or television sets, I suspect no one has gotten that far yet. This is a little bit too esoteric a measurement for Consumers Report to measure it, but to your knowledge, has anyone measured the overload characteristics and or noise figure of the currently available converter boxes or digital TV sets? I suspect that the front-end actual RF amplifier is almost identical to the previous design, and that maybe not much has changed. It's only the circuitry downrange that has become digital. That's a guess on my part. You might have an opinion on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
K2RAW, K2J. if you go through Mr. Signoli's stuff, you'll find that they've actually made some actual real measurements of receivers. Typically, the design of the front end is the same as the analog. It really isn't much different today. As far as filters go, you can buy block filters, you can buy single channel filters, you can order them to, that actually are sold in rings, where you can block out, say, channels 53 through 60. Those are really sold for the purpose of cable TV systems and master antenna systems, where they're actually replacing those channels with other stuff coming from local modulators and local head end stuff. So, I mean, that stuff's available. But don't forget, my 60 kilowatts is really centered around a single frequency within the 6 megahertz, whereas the digital stuff is right across the 6 megahertz. So it's not as big an issue in terms of, well, I'm really quite close to it, so you know that constantly, you know, banging into the preamp is not a healthy thing to happen, but, you know, I'm an unusual case, but I use a single channel filter to notch it out, although it doesn't take it all away, but it does a pretty good job, so the one transistor in the preamp isn't really being saturated by it, and that was my goal. As far as the signal noise of digital receivers are concerned, there's a single value. As long as you reach that value, and that's considered to be 27 dB signal noise, anything above that is gravy, because either it works or it don't. If you go below that value, you begin to have problems. You go above that value, you can go to, you know, minus 36, minus 40, and you don't buy anything, unless, of course, you're trying to pick up something 100 miles away, and that's not the normal case, so to speak. K2IWK, to you guys.
Okay, let's run that one by again. You just said 27 dB of, I'm going to call it carrier-to-noise ratio, gives you, in theory, beautiful digital television reception, everything else being equal. Does that mean at 25 or 26 dB of positive carrier-to-noise ratio, my system gives up and says, go away? Back to you on that one, Eric.
I put it this way. If you're minus 26, chances are you're seeing pictures that block and stall, and possibly, if you go to minus 25, you see nothing.
Okay. You're now, when you talk about minus 25, minus 26, whatever, you're talking about DBM, we got to be careful with the units here. I live in a DBM world. Everything I've ever done with countermeasures engineering talks about positive power in plus DBM. I think you're speaking now in the minus DB microvolt world. So when you say 27 decibels and you said negative, that's acceptable. And if that's DBMV, I think you're saying minus 28 is where it's likely to drop out. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I'm actually not talking DBMV. You know, I'm so used to seeing the values now, I'm actually not sure how it's referenced. Give me a second and I'll tell you exactly.
Okay. Take your time on that one. Let's pick up Press. He's been waiting patiently. W2, Papa Whiskey. Go right ahead, Press, with your question or comment. K2LAW, my name is Dick.
W2, Papa Whiskey, you bring up an excellent point. DB is only half of a phrase. DB always must be referenced to something. DBM, and which M is it? A millivolt, a microvolt, a microwatt? Munchkins? But, you know, to say DB, DB is always the kind of thing that means more than or less than, as far as I know. But my question is, I've always heard of noise figure expressed as dB, and I always think of dB as, okay, an amplifier's got 3 dB gain, a coax has got 3 dB loss, but what the heck is noise figure when you say a 3 dB noise figure? Doesn't that mean 3 dB more than something else, or how does that work, W2CW?
Don, good question.
Oh, boy.
Into a beauty here. First of all, the IEEE way back in the late 40s, when Noyes Figure with Mumford and Scheib at Bell Laboratories, who wrote a beautiful book that I used to have a copy of and I can't find it on Noyes Figure. Let me backtrack. How did Noyes Figure come about? Okay. Halleck Crafter and I'm trying to think of all the other brand names that were popular of amateur radio receivers and broadcast and communications receivers back in the late 30s, early 40s. Hamelin and other various brands would say, our receiver will receive a good signal at 0.5 microvolt. And along comes another guy who says, my receiver is better than yours. It receives a good signal at 0.25 microvolt. But what was going on here is that some of these guys were using a more and more narrow IF filter, which led to less noise. Therefore, a weaker signal for CW with a more narrow filter would give you a better threshold. That's the good news. If you try to get audio through that single sideband or AM modulated audio through that narrow filter that gave you the quarter of microvolt of sensitivity, it sounded like hell. It sounded like somebody talking to a bale of cotton. The low frequency notes there and everything else was gone. So in order to get around that problem, that's one of the reasons why Noyes Figure was created. The IEEE defines Noyes Figure. Let me jump. You could say the reference is 290 degrees Kelvin. In other words, everything that we call Noyes Figure really relates back to what is the equivalent noise temperature of the first stage of your receiver. If I had a 50 ohm resistor and I heated it to 290 degrees Kelvin, which is a little bit below room temperature, and if I connected very good instrumentation to that resistor, because its physical temperature is above absolute zero, and those molecules in there are being shaken around, that's what temperature is, average kinetic energy of the molecule, and the electrons with them are being shaken, it makes noise. Everything in the world that's above absolute zero that has any insertion loss to it makes noise. So that 50 ohm resistor at room temperature, if I connect it to very good instrumentation, I would find out the noise power coming out of that resistor is minus 114 dBm per megacycle, dB with reference to a milliwatt, minus 114 dBm, when using a receiver that has a noise equivalent bandwidth of 1 megacycle. So that's the definition. That's the reference point by the IEEE. So when we talk about decibels of Noyes Figure and what a 50 ohm resistor will do when sitting at room temperature, that turns out to be equivalent to 3.01 dB Noyes Figure. If I had a receiver whose equivalent noise power generated by the first stage is equivalent to a 50 ohm resistor, not at room temperature, 290 Kelvin, 290 absolute scale, but half of that, 145 degrees Kelvin. The nice thing about Noyes Figure and noise characteristics, when you relate it to temperature, that's the one place where everything is linear. Decibels are only linear for instrumentation that sits at room temperature. Whenever you connect an antenna to your electronics and the antenna is aimed at cold sky, even though your antenna is sitting at room temperature physically, because your antenna is aimed at cold sky, you have a cryogenic system. Cold sky is 3 degrees Kelvin, not 290. So if you've got a cryogenic system, and if you start making measurements of Noyes Figure and whatever with decibels, everything starts turning out very nonlinear looking if you're not smart enough. But if you keep relating everything back to degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise power generated...
Repeater, timeout.
Cancel. Generated by a 50 ohm resistor. And by the way, when I use the word 50 ohm resistor, I'm just relating it to normal ham radio equipment. There's nothing magic about 50 ohms. I will get the exact same noise power out of a 70 ohm resistor or a 200 ohm resistor at 290 Kelvin. I'll get exactly minus 114 dBm per megacycle if I impedance match to that resistor value. If I had a 300 ohm resistor and I've got 300 ohm laboratory instrumentation, I'll get the same power. So, power of a impedance-matched resistor is one of our references, and Noyes Figure in decibels turns out to really be with reference to 290 Kelvin, but that's hidden in there. And so, if we talk about a 3 dB Noyes Figure, you could say it's 3 dB away from ideal. Ideal would mean that's 0 degrees Kelvin. no noise being generated. And with 3 dB away from that. Well, it's not quite as simple as that. 3 dB, by way of this crazy definition of 290 Kelvin, reference point. The first time you hear all this jazz press, it's not going to go down easily. I know where you are, just saying, what in the world's going on here? W2PW, K2LIW. Good question.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, I guess if you just take it a practical matter, if you take a lousy, like a shortwave preamp, and you connect it to a shortwave receiver with no antenna connected, all of a sudden your background hiss goes up a lot. You say, oh, I got a bad noise figure preamp here. And I guess, you know, when the rubber hits the road, if you got a bad noise figure preamp, your weak signals may be stronger, but they'll be masked by extra crap that it's just coming up with.
There's both a yes and a no to what you just sort of asked, Chris. Whenever you take a 10 gig crystal controlled tunable IF converter, that's example number one, a 1296 tunable converter, a 144 meg all mode receiver, an HF receiver, Richter, and 14 megacycles, any one of those receivers, with nothing connected to the front end but a 50 ohm load resistor, I have a certain amount of noise that appears coming out of that loudspeaker. I have a certain amount of movement of that S meter. Whenever I add a preamp to the system, the first thing you want to know is the system noise starved? Is there enough preamplification? And if I put a properly operating preamp, where the preamp itself has a 50 ohm resistor on the input of it, if I add that preamp and the noise coming out of the receiver increases, or the S meter moves a little bit upscale, then in general I have enough preamplification. You have to be able to see your own front end if you want a state-of-the-art receiver system with that sensitivity. At first that sounds crazy. Hey, I'm putting a preamp in order to lower the sensitivity. I don't want the preamp to have noise. So if I put on a preamp, why do I see more noise coming out of the receiver? You have to. Let me show you why. In the example we've been talking about, let's assume now that I've got a 3 decibel noise figure preamplifier with 20 decibels of gain. The 20 decibels of gain tells me that whatever is going on in the front end, whether it be signal or noise, the preamplifier can't tell the difference. One of those things going through there is my particular signal on 146.25 megacycles right now. That's the one I care about. I call that signal. And all the stuff around it, I call it noise. The preamp is not smart enough. It doesn't know the difference. It sees a certain amount of noise. It sees a certain amount of what I call signal. It takes the composite of all those and gains it up by 20 dB in my example. So a perfectly operating 3 dB noise figure preamp with 20 decibels of gain, when I connect it to my receiver, I might see a 10 decibel increase in noise coming out of the receiver. And that's perfectly all right. There's a certain amount of noise increase that you should see. If I add a 20 dB preamp, and I see 23 dB of noise increase, so
repeater, timeout, cancel.
I add a 20 dB preamp, and I see 23 dB of noise increase, something is awful bad. And you notice that I kept saying, add a 50 ohm resistor on the front end of the preamp. In many cases, a state-of-the-art preamp that is truly open-circuited on its input connector might break into oscillation. If the manufacturer did a real good job and he made that preamp unconditionally stable, where any impedance you can connect to the front end is okay, no problem. Very few manufacturers have done that. That takes a whole lot of extra engineering smart. So without a 50 ohm resistor on first the receiver and then on the preamp, you're not doing a fair test, and a certain amount of noise increase should be there. You and I are smart enough for our press to calculate how much noise increase should be there when I add the preamp. And there better be a noise increase. If not, you have a system that is still gain-starved. If I add a preamp in the front end of a receiver, properly terminated input connector preamp, and I see no increase in noise coming out of the loudspeaker and no movement of the S-meter, I still have a gain-starved system. Or I have a receiver who has a front end that's dead and has been blown out by the last lightning storm, and I ought to go looking for what's going on. I wonder if it makes a little more sense, Press. Whiskey 2, Papa Whiskey. The voice of Petra, K2LIW.
I think I got a lot of what you said. And I'm closing, let's get back to net. I thoroughly enjoyed your article on S-band Apollo reception And when I was reading it, I heard in my mind's ear your voice narrating it. It was a fun article to read. Thank you, 73K2RIW, W2PW model.
KA2YHY.
KA2YHY, recognized. But let me go back, Preston. Were you reading August 1972 QST, which is way back in the dark ages? What were you reading, Preston? Go ahead, when you thought you heard my voice.
That's the one. And fortunately, AWRL has now made old reprints available to members on their website. I just simply went there. I searched for K2RIW. No, I searched for the word Apollo. And there were a couple of different Houston, this is Apollo articles. And, of course, I read yours.
Okay, thank you for the compliment. K2 Yankee Hotel Yankee. I should know you. Start up with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to the net. Name here is Steve, and yes, you should. Name is Steve, and longtime member of the club. Talking about the digital television, I listen to the audio portion of the broadcast television band on a scanner, and I'm sure I'm not going to be able to do that in the next few months. Is there any way, without buying a new scanner, that I might be able to digitize that signal and get it into the scanner? I was thinking about buying one of these converter boxes and somehow connecting it up to the scanner. Is that feasible? Any words of wisdom on that?
Good, unusual guy. In the Rimark list, you're listed as Malvern. In the QRZ list, you're listed as Sussex, New Jersey. You obviously have more than one home. I'm going to turn that question of yours, a darn good question, Steve, over to our broadcast engineer, Eric. I'm a little bit worried that the answer might be no. There may be no simple way of getting just the audio out of that digital signal into a scanner. Let's see if Eric's got a way of doing that. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, if you've got a particular channel you like to listen to, you can get one of those $40 converter boxes and hook it up to a little FM modulator and listen to it on his FM radio. If your scanner does wideband FM, that's another way to do it. I wouldn't recommend putting it on a commercial frequency or a ham frequency, because that would be a no-no. But you can get a small 100 milliwatt FM transmitter. You can buy a kit. For your iPod, they have these little boxes you plug in. And that would be the way to go. You could do that. And I've got a response to you on digital signal noise and what the meaning of that number is. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. And, Steve, I made a hell of a mistake here. I wrote you down as K2 instead of KA2. So ignore my comments about where you live. Tell us about the -27. Is that dB with reference to a microvolt? What is it? Or is it carrier-to-noise ratio? And I'm going to have another question along these lines if you answer this one. You got it, Eric.
Dick, WSLN on a previous question.
All recognized. I'm going to come back to you. Eric, right now, go ahead.
All right. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to read you a little blurb written by somebody else. And it's called Digital Signal Noise Ratio. All right. Signal noise ratio specification is pretty much what you were talking about before. Well, there's a different meaning for digital modulation. Digital signal noise ratio is not simply the ratio of signal power to noise and cannot be directly compared to analog signal noise ratio. Digital signal noise ratio is the ratio of average symbol power to the signal of the average power expressed in decibel. The error power consists of anything that causes a displacement of the symbol from the intended level of state. In other words, phase noise, group delay, response error, nonlinearities, etc. Currently, the ATSC recommends the transmitter signal noise ratio be 27 dB or greater. Signal noise ratio can be approximated from error vector modulation by the following formula. Signal noise ratio equals 20 log EVM. I'm going to drop. In order to achieve optimal coverage, it is desirable to have a value of signal noise ratio to be as high as possible, but there's a price to pay in attempting to reach a certain value.
the curve of system signal noise ratio to receiver carrier to noise ratio is asymptotic, such as exceeding the knee of the curve provides diminishing benefit. That's what I was talking about. You know, getting it better than 27 dB doesn't buy you much. The exceeding the ATSC recommended signal noise level, ratio level of 27 dB may slightly increase the coverage area, but the benefits can be outweighed by the cost of doing so. Higher transmitter power, complex correction, etc., etc., etc. So there is really what we're talking about. It's error vector magnitude and signal noise ratio can be used to quantify transmitter system performance, but care must be taken when interpreting the results of these measurements. Poor EVM or SNR performance is simply an indication of a problem in the system. So really, we're not talking so much about carrier to noise ratio. We're really relating this to what's going on with the symbol K2IWK2J.
Okay, that gives me another set of questions. When you were reading that, you talked about 27 dB of noise as acceptable, and you made it sound like it's a positive number. Previously, you called it minus 27. Is it plus 27 dB of average symbol power versus total error vector power? Could I describe it as that way? And I think 27 dB is the magic number where the receiver should work well, and it might fail at plus 26 dB of average symbol power to error vector total. I'm adding words here, and I may have created a problem. Let's see if I did, Eric. Over to you, Eric.
No, actually, you corrected me. It is a positive number.
Okay, I'm having a little bit more understanding now. Let's see what Paul's got to say. CS2N. Hey, Paul, this digital jazz, I mean, we've been discussing it now for 4 weeks. We are the experts, but we know it all. You believe that? I'll tell you another. CS2N, KQLAW.
Okay, very good. Gary, I had a question regarding the previous question, dealing with the scanners. And okay, and the digital stuff. Look how good the digital stuff is working from Mars. Less than 5 years for spirit and opportunity thing. Instead of 3 months. The previous question had to do with the scanner receiving the regular channels, you know, 2 through 13 on a scanner. Now, Eric kind of solved that problem, I thought, a month or so ago, and I even went through the process of, you know, running the experiment with my VCR. He said if you hook up rabbit ears to the discharge or the output side of these converter boxes, you'll actually get a transmission, and then you can pick it up with other TVs that you might have, battery-operated TVs with maybe no coaxial connection in the back. You just, you know, put up your rabbit ears and you'll receive it. I went through that process with the VCR. I said it would work on a VCR. It did. I tried that here and got both audio and picture. But what are you saying? That maybe the scanner, I wonder what Eric's saying, maybe the scanner isn't capable of doing that, or wouldn't that work for him, Eric? Or back to you, WS1.
If I understand correctly, what Steve was asking us is,